On the Road by Jack Kerouac. With the coming of Dean Moriarty began the part of my life you could call my life on the road. Before that, I'd often dreamed of going west to see the country, always vaguely planning and never taking off. Dean is the perfect guy for the road because he actually was born on the road when his parents were passing through Salt Lake City in 1926 in a jalopy on their way to Los Angeles. First reports of him came to me through Chad King, who showed me a few letters from him written in a New Mexico reform school. Then news came that he was out and was coming to New York for the first time. Also, that he'd just married a girl called Mary Lou. One day I was hanging around the campus, and Chad and Tim Gray told me Dean was staying in a cold water pad in East Harlem. I went to the flat with the boys, and Dean came to the door in his shorts. Mary Lou was jumping off the couch. Dean had dispatched the occupants of the apartment to the kitchen while he proceeded with his love problems, for to him, sex was the one and only holy and important thing in his life. My first impression of Dean was of a young Gene Autry, trim, thin-hipped, blue-eyed, with a real Oklahoma accent, a sideburn hero of the snowy West. In fact, he'd just been working on a ranch, Ed Walls, in Colorado, before marrying Mary Lou and coming east. Mary Lou was a pretty blonde with immense ringlets of hair like a sea of golden tresses. She sat there on the edge of the couch with her hands hanging in her lap and her smoky blue country eyes fixed in a wide stare. During the following week, Dean confided in Chad King that he absolutely had to learn how to write. Chad said I was a writer. He came right out to Paterson, New Jersey, where I was living with my aunt. One night while I was studying, there was a knock on the door. And there was Dean. "And where's Mary Lou?" I asked. Dean said, "She'd gone back to Denver, the whore." We went out and had a few beers because we couldn't talk like we wanted to talk in front of my aunt, who sat in the living room reading her paper. She took one look at Dean and decided he was a madman. Nonetheless, we understood each other. I agreed that he could stay at my house till he found a job, and furthermore, we agreed to go out west sometime. That was the winter of 1947. One night he leaned over my shoulder as I typed and said, "Come on, man. Those girls won't wait. Make it fast." I said, "I'll be right with you as soon as I finish this chapter." We went to New York. I forget what the situation was. Two colored girls, they were supposed to meet him in a diner and didn't show up. And that was the night Dean met Carlo Marx. Two keen minds that they are, they took to each other at the drop of a hat. Two piercing eyes glanced into two piercing eyes. The holy con man with the shining mind and the sorrowful, poetic con man with the dark mind that is Carlo Marx. They rushed down the street together, digging everything. They danced like dingle doties, and I shambled after as I've been doing all my life after people who interest me. Because the only people for me are the mad ones, the ones who are mad to live, mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time. Then came spring, and everybody was getting ready to take one trip or another. I was busily working on my novel. When I got to the halfway mark, I got ready to travel west for the very first time. Dean had already left. Carlo and I saw him off at the 34th Street Greyhound station. We had a farewell meal of Franks and beans in a 7th Avenue Rikers, and then Dean got on the bus that said Chicago and roared off into the night. My friend Remy Boncour had written me from San Francisco, saying I should come and stay with him. He said he had a shack in Mill City, and I would have all the time in the world to write. He was living with a girl called Leanne. He said she was a marvelous cook. He expected me to arrive in 10 days. So, leaving my manuscript sitting on top of my desk and folding back my comfortable home sheets for the last time, I left with my canvas bag and took off for the Pacific Ocean. On the road map was one long red line called Route 6 that went from the tip of Cape Cod clear to Ely, Nevada, and there dipped down to Los Angeles. I started confidently. 5 rides took me to Bear Mountain Bridge, where Route 6 arced in from New England. Not only was there no traffic, but the rain came down in buckets, and I had no shelter. I had to run under some pines to take cover. This did no good. I began crying and swearing and socking myself in the head for being such a damn fool. I was 40 miles north of New York. All the way up, I'd been worried about the fact that on this, my big opening day, I was moving north instead of the so longed for west. Now I was stuck on my northernmost hang-up. Finally, a car stopped. The people let me in and rode me to Newburgh, which I accepted as a better alternative than being trapped in the Bear Mountain wilderness all night. "Besides," said the man, "there's no traffic passes through 6. You'd do better going across the Holland Tunnel in New York and head for Pittsburgh." And I knew he was right. In Newburgh, it had stopped raining. I had to ride back to New York in a bus with a delegation of school teachers. Chatter, chatter, blah, blah, and me swearing for all the time and money I'd wasted. I swore I'd be in Chicago tomorrow. I made sure of that by taking a bus. I was spending most of my money, but I didn't give a damn, just so long as I'd be in Chicago tomorrow. I arrived in Chi quite early in the morning, got a room in the Y, and went to bed. I dug Chicago after a good day's sleep. The following afternoon, I went into the West. It was a warm and beautiful day for hitchhiking. My first ride was a dynamite truck with a red flag, about 30 miles into Great Green, Illinois. Long about 3 in the afternoon, after an apple pie and ice cream in a roadside stand, a woman stopped for me in a little coupe. She wanted somebody to help her drive to Iowa. She drove the first few hours, and then I took the wheel and drove clear through the rest of Illinois to Davenport, Iowa. And here, for the first time in my life, I saw my beloved Mississippi River. Dry in the summer haze, low water, with its big rank smell, it smells like the raw body of America itself. Here I got out. I took a bus in downtown Davenport and rode to the city limits near the gas stations. Here the big trucks roared, wham, and inside 2 minutes, one of them cranked to a stop for me. I ran for it with my soul whooping. And what a driver. A great big tough truck driver with popping eyes and a hoarse, raspy voice who just slammed and kicked at everything and got his rig underway and paid hardly any attention to me. Just as we rolled into Iowa City, he saw another truck coming behind us. Because he had to turn off, he blinked his taillights at the other guy and slowed down for me to jump out. And the other truck, acknowledging this exchange, stopped for me. And once again, in the twink of nothing, I was in another big high cab, all set to go hundreds of miles across the night. And was I happy? At dawn, the smoke of Des Moines appeared ahead over the green cornfields. Now I wanted to sleep a whole day. I wound up in a gloomy old Plains Inn of a hotel by the locomotive roundhouse and spent a long day sleeping on a big, clean, hard, white bed with dirty remarks carved in the wall beside my pillow. I woke as the sun was reddening. I said so long to the old hotel keeper sitting by his spittoon and went to eat. I ate apple pie and ice cream. It was getting better as I got deeper into Iowa. I immediately got a ride from a farmer and his son heading out for Adele in Iowa. In this town, under a big elm tree near a gas station, I made the acquaintance of another hitchhiker, a typical New Yorker, an Irishman who'd been driving a truck for the post office most of his work years and was now headed for a girl in Denver and a new life. We got a ride to Stewart, Iowa, a town in which we were really stranded. We spent some time trying to sleep on the bench at the railroad ticket office, but the telegraph clicked all night and the big freights were slamming around outside. When the Omaha bus came through just before dawn, we hopped on it and joined the sleeping passengers. I paid his fare. His name was Eddie. He reminded me of my cousin-in-law from the Bronx. That was why I stuck with him. We arrived at Council Bluffs at dawn. All winter, I'd been reading of the great wagon parties that held council there before hitting the Oregon and Santa Fe trails. And of course, now it was only cute suburban cottages all laid out in the dismal gray dawn. Then Omaha. And by God, the first cowboy I saw in a 10-gallon hat and Texas boots looked like any beat character of the brick-walled dawns of the East, except for the get-up. We got off the bus and walked clear up the hill, the long hill formed over the millenniums by the mighty Missouri, and got to the country and stuck our thumbs out. We got a ride from a couple of young fellows, wranglers, teenagers, country boys in a put-together jalopy, and were left off somewhere up the line in a thin drizzle of rain. The drizzle increased and Eddie got cold. He had very little clothing. I fished a wool plaid shirt from my canvas bag and he put it on. He felt a little better. I had a cold. Eddie turned out to be a pretty absent-minded pal of the road. A funny old contraption rolled by, driven by an old man. It was made of some kind of aluminum, square as a box. A trailer, no doubt. But a weird, crazy Nebraska homemade trailer. He was going very slow and stopped. We rushed up. He said he could only take one. Without a word, Eddie jumped in and slowly rattled from my sight, and wearing my wool plaid shirt. Well, alackaday, I kissed the shirt goodbye. I waited several hours, and I kept thinking it was getting night. Actually, it was only early afternoon, but dark. Denver, Denver, how would I ever get to Denver? A fairly new car stopped, driven by a young guy. Where are you going? Denver. Well, I can take you 100 miles up the line. Grand, grand, you saved my life. We talked, and I started to sleep some and woke up right outside the town of Gothenburg, where he let me off. The greatest ride in my life was about to come up, a truck with a flatboard at the back with about 6 or 7 boys sprawled out on it. The drivers, 2 young blonde farmers from Minnesota, were picking up every single soul they found on that road. I ran up and said, "Is there room?" They said, "Sure, hop on. There's room for everybody." I looked at the company. There were 2 young farmer boys from North Dakota in red baseball caps, and they were headed for the harvests. There were 2 young city boys from Columbus, Ohio, high school football players, chewing gum, winking, singing in the breeze. "We're going to L.A., they yelled. "What are you going to do there?" "Hell, we don't know. Who cares?" Then there was a tall, slim fellow who had a sneaky look. "Where are you from?" I asked. And he turned slowly to me, opened his mouth, and said, "Montana." Finally, there was Mississippi Gene in his charge. Mississippi Gene was a little dark guy who rode freight trains around the country. A hobo with a youthful look, so you couldn't tell exactly what age he was. His charge was a 16-year-old tall blonde kid. They wore old clothes that had been turned black by the soot of railroads and the dirt of boxcars. The blonde kid was quiet. He looked straight ahead and wet his lips in worried thought. I was glad when the farm boys who owned the truck decided to stop in North Platte and eat. "Piss call," said one. "Time to eat," said the other. We all shambled after them to a restaurant and sat around over hamburgers and coffee while they wrapped away enormous meals, just as if they were in their mother's kitchen. Everybody had joined them except the 2 hobo kids, Gene and his boy. When we all got back, they were still sitting in the truck, forlorn and disconsolate. Now the darkness was falling. The drivers had a smoke. I jumped at the chance to go buy a bottle of whiskey to keep warm in the rushing cold air of the night. They smiled when I told them, "Go ahead, hurry up." I felt something different in the air in North Platte. I didn't know what it was. In 5 minutes, I did. We got back on the truck and roared off. It got dark quickly. We all had a shot, and suddenly I looked, and the verdant farm fields of the Platte began to disappear, and in their stead, so far you couldn't see to the end, were long, flat wastelands of sand and sagebrush. "What the hell is this?" I cried out to Slim. "This is the beginning of the rangelands, boy. Hand me another drink." Soon I realized I was at last over Colorado, not officially in it, but looking southward towards Denver itself, a few 100 miles away. I yelled for joy. We passed the bottle. The great blazing stars came out. The far receding sand hills got dim. I felt like an arrow that could shoot out all the way. We came suddenly into the town of Oglala. The 2 Dakota boys said goodbye to everybody and figured they'd start harvesting here. We watched them disappear in the night towards the shacks at the end of town where the lights were burning. The truck was ready to go. It was getting on midnight now and cold. Mississippi Gene said the best thing to do now was for all of us to bundle up under the big tarpaulin or we'd freeze. In this manner, with the rest of the bottle, we kept warm as the air grew ice cold and pinged our ears. The stars seemed to get brighter the more we climbed the high plains. We were in Wyoming now. Flat on my back, I stared straight up at the magnificent firmament, glorying in the time I was making, and how far I had come from sad Bear Mountain after all, and tingling with kicks at the thought of what lay ahead of me in Denver, whatever, whatever it would be. Montana Slim woke up and said to me, "Hey, how about you and me investigating Cheyenne tonight before you go on to Denver?" Sure thing, I was drunk enough to go for anything. As the truck reached the outskirts of Cheyenne, we saw the high red lights of the local radio station, and suddenly we were bucking through a great crowd of people that poured along both sidewalks. Hell's bells, it's Wild West week, said Slim. We had to jump off the truck and say goodbye. The Minnesotans weren't interested in hanging around. It was sad to see them go, and I realized that I would never see any of them again. But that's the way it was. We started hitting the bars. I had about $7, five of which I foolishly squandered that night. We picked up two girls, a pretty young blonde and a fat brunette. We took them to a rickety nightclub that was already closing, and there I spent all but $2 on scotch for them and beer for us. I was getting drunk and didn't care. Everything was fine. My whole being and purpose was pointed at that little blonde. I wanted to go in there. The blonde said she wanted to go home, in Colorado, just over the line south of Cheyenne. I'll take you in a bus, I said. No, the bus stops on the highway, and I have to walk across that damn prairie all by myself. Aw, listen. We'll take a nice walk in the prairie flowers. Ain't no flowers there, she said. I want to go to New York. I'm sick and tired of this. Ain't no place to go but Cheyenne, and ain't nothing in Cheyenne. Ain't nothing in New York. Hell or ain't, she said, with a curl of her lips. The bus station was crowded to the doors. Slim was dozing on a bench. I sat down. Bus stations are all the same all over the country. They give a feeling of sadness that only bus stations have. I curled up in a seat with my canvas bag for a pillow and slept till 8 o'clock in the morning. I woke up with a big headache. Slim was gone. To Montana, I guess. I went outside, and there in the blue air I saw for the first time, far off, the great snowy tops of the Rocky Mountains. I took a deep breath. I had to get to Denver at once. First I ate a breakfast, a modest one of toast and coffee and one egg, and then I cut out of town to the highway. I got a ride right off in a brand new car driven by a Denver businessman of about 35. He went 70. I tingled all over. I counted minutes and subtracted miles. Just ahead, over the rolling wheat fields all golden beneath the distant snow of Estes, I'd be seeing old Denver at last. Before I knew it, we were going over the wholesale fruit markets outside Denver. There were smokestacks, smoke, rail yards, red brick buildings, and the distant downtown Greystone. He left me off at Larimer Street. I stumbled along with the most wicked grin of joy in the world among the old bums and beat cowboys. I moved in with Roland Major in a really swank apartment that belonged to Tim Gray's folks. We each had a bedroom, and there was a kitchenette with food in the icebox and a huge living room where Major sat in his silk dressing gown composing his latest Hemingwayan short story, a choleric, pudgy hater of everything who could turn on the warmest and most charming smile in the world when real life confronted him in the night. Major liked good wines. He reminisced about his recent trip to France. Ah, Sal, if you could sit with me high in the Basque country with a cool bottle of Pognon 19, then you'd know there are other things besides boxcars. The Rawlinses lived a few blocks away. A youngish mother, part owner of a decrepit hotel, with five sons and two daughters. The wild son was Ray Rawlins, Tim Gray's boyhood buddy. Ray came roaring in to get me, and we took to each other right away. We went off and drank in the Colfax bars. One of Ray's sisters was a beautiful blonde called Babe. She was Tim Gray's girl. And Major was going out with Tim Gray's sister, Betty. Then it happened. The phone rang, and it was Carlo Marx. I said, "What are you doing in Denver? I mean, what are you doing? What's going on?" "Oh, wait till I tell you." I rushed over to meet him. He was working in May's department store nights. "And where is Dean?" "Dean is in Denver, let me tell you." And he told me that Dean was making love to two girls at the same time, they being Mary Lou, his wife, who waited for him in a hotel room, and Camille, a new girl, who waited for him in a hotel room. Between the two of them, he rushes to me for our own unfinished business. And what business is that? Dean and I are embarked on a tremendous season together. We're trying to communicate with absolute honesty and absolute completeness everything on our minds. We've had to take Benzedrine. I have finally taught Dean that he can do anything he wants, become mayor of Denver, marry a millionairess, or become the greatest poet since Rambo. Carlo and I went through rickety streets in the Denver night. The air was soft, the stars so fine, the promise of every cobbled alley so great that I thought I was in a dream. We came to the rooming house where Dean haggled with Camille. We went up carpeted stairs. Carlo knocked. Then he darted to the back to hide. He didn't want Camille to see him. I stood in the door. Dean opened it stark naked. I saw a brunette on the bed, one beautiful creamy thigh covered with black lace, look up with mild wonder. "Why, Sal," said Dean. "Well, now, yes, of course, you've arrived. You old sumbitch, you finally got on that old road. Well, now, look here, we must... Yes, at once, we must... We really must. Now, Camille..." And he swirled on her. "Sal is here. This is my old buddy from New York. This is his first night in Denver, and it's absolutely necessary for me to take him out and fix him up with a girl." Off we rushed into the night. Carlo joined us in an alley. We talked in loud voices in the sleeping stillness. "Sal," said Dean, "I have just the girl waiting for you at this very minute, if she's off duty," looking at his watch. "A waitress, Rita Betancourt. Fine chick, slightly hung up on a few sexual difficulties, which I've tried to straighten up, and I think you can manage, you fine gone daddy, you. So we'll go there at once. We must bring beer." "No, they have some themselves." "And damn," he said, socking his palm, "I've just got to get into her sister Mary tonight." "What?" said Carl. "I thought we were going to talk." "Yes, yes, after." We got to the house where the waitress sisters lived. The one for me was still working. The sister that Dean wanted was in. We sat on her couch. I was scheduled at this time to call Ray Rollins. I did. He came over at once. Bottles rolled on the floor. 3 o'clock came. The other sister showed up. We needed a car now, and we were making too much noise. Ray Rollins called up a buddy with a car. He came. We all piled in. "Let's go to my apartment," I shouted. We did. We ran shouting into the building. Roland Major stood barring our way in his silk dressing gown. "I'll have no goings-on like this in Tim Gray's apartment." "What?" we all shouted. There was confusion. Major wouldn't let us in. We rushed back to the Denver downtown hangouts. I suddenly found myself alone on the street with no money. I walked 5 miles up Colfax to my comfortable bed. Major had to let me in. I slept like a log. Carlo's basement room was on Grant Street in an old red brick rooming house near a church. It was like the room of a Russian saint. One bed, a candle burning, stone walls that oozed moisture, and a crazy makeshift icon that he had made. He read me his latest poem. It was called Denver Doldrums. Carlo woke up in the morning and heard the vulgar pigeons yakking in the street outside his cell. He saw the sad nightingales nodding on the branches, and they reminded him of his mother. The mountains, the magnificent Rockies, were papier-mâché. He wrote of Dean as a child of the rainbow who bore his torment in his agonized priapus. Dean came on schedule. "Everything's straight," he announced. "I'm going to divorce Mary Lou and marry Camille and go live with her in San Francisco." Then they got down to business. They sat on the bed cross-legged and looking straight at each other. They began with an abstract thought, discussed it, reminded each other of another abstract point forgotten in the rush of events. Dean apologized, but promised that he could get back to it and manage it fine, bringing up illustrations. Carlo said, "And just as we were crossing Wazi, I wanted to tell you about how I felt concerning your passion for midget racing cars. And it was just then, remember, you pointed out that old bum with the baggy pants and said he looked just like your father." "Yes, yes, of course I remember. And not only that, but it started a train of my own, something really wild that I had to tell you. I'd forgotten it. Now you just reminded me." And 2 new points were born. They hashed these over. Then Carlo asked Dean if he was honest, and specifically if he was being honest with him in the bottom of his soul. "Why'd you bring that up again?" "There's just one last thing I want to know." And on into the night they talked like this. At dawn I looked up. They were tying up the last of the morning's matters. When I said I had to sleep because of Mary Lou, that is, seeing her this morning at 10, I didn't bring my peremptory tone to bear in regard to what you just said about the unnecessariness of sleep, but only, mind you, because of the fact that I absolutely, simply, purely, and without any whatevers, have to sleep now. I mean, man, my eyes are closing. They're red hot, sore, tired, beat. "Ah, child," said Carlo, We'll just have to sleep now. Let's stop the machine. You can't stop the machine, yelled Carlo at the top of his voice. The first bird sang. I didn't see Carlo for 5 days. He told me he'd been in Central City with Dean. What did you do? Oh, we ran around the bars, and then Dean stole a car, and we drove back down the mountain 90 miles an hour. Well, man, I'm going to San Francisco, I said. Dean has Rita lined up for you tonight. Well, then I'll put it off. I went to meet Rita Betancourt and took her back to the apartment. I got her in my bedroom after a long talk in the dark. She was a nice little girl, simple and true and tremendously frightened of sex. I told her it was beautiful. I wanted to prove this to her. She let me, but I was too impatient and proved nothing. She sighed in the dark. What do you want out of life? I asked. I don't know, she said. Just wait on tables and try to get along. She yawned. I put my hand over her mouth and told her not to yawn. I tried to tell her how excited I was about life and the things we could do together, saying that and planning to leave Denver in 2 days. She turned away wearily. We lay on our backs, looking at the ceiling and wondering what God had wrought when he made life so sad. My moments in Denver were coming to an end. I walked her home. On the way back, I stretched out on the grass of an old church with a bunch of hobos. The night was warm and soft. They talked of harvests moving north. It made me want to get back on that road. I was 2 weeks late meeting Remy Boncourt. Mill City, where he lived, was a collection of shacks in a valley, housing project shacks built for Navy Yard workers during the war. It was in a canyon, treed profusely on all slopes. On the door of Remy's shack was the note he had pinned up 3 weeks before. Sal Paradise. If nobody's home, climb in through the window. I climbed in, and there he was, sleeping with his girl, Leanne. When I found him that morning, he had fallen on the beat and evil days that come to young guys in their middle 20s. He was hanging around waiting for his ship, and to earn a living, he had a job as a special guard in the barracks across the canyon. His girl, Leanne, had a bad tongue and gave him a call down every day. Remy wore shorts around the shack with an army cap on his head. Leanne went around with her hair up in pin curls. Thus attired, they yelled at each other all week. I never saw so many snarls in all my born days. Remy arranged to get me the same job he had. I had to have navy blue trousers to go with my black jacket and cop cap. For the first 2 weeks, I had to wear Remy's trousers. Since he was so tall and had a pot belly, I went flapping around like Charlie Chaplin. On my first night of work, Remy gave me a flashlight and his .32 automatic. I climbed the steep walls of the South Canyon, got up on the highway, scrambled down the other side, and came to the bottom of a ravine. Then it was a fast walk along a silvery, dusty road. Then I climbed another hill, and there were the barracks. They were for the temporary quartering of overseas construction workers. The men who came through stayed there, waiting for their ship. Most of them were bound for Okinawa. The job of the special guard was to see that they didn't tear the barracks down. One night the schedule was so arranged that I was all alone for 6 hours, the only cop on the grounds, and everybody seemed to have got drunk that night. I took my flashlight and went to the noisiest door and knocked. Someone opened it about 6 inches. What do you want? I said, I'm guarding these barracks tonight, and you boys are supposed to keep quiet. They slammed the door. I stood looking at the wood of it against my nose. I knocked again. They opened up wide this time. Listen, I said, I don't want to come around bothering you fellas, but I'll lose my job if you make too much noise. Who are you? I'm a guard. Never seen you before. Well, here's my badge. Have a drink, for Christ's sake. I didn't mind if I did. I took two. I went to all the doors in this manner, and pretty soon I was as drunk as anybody else. Come dawn, it was my duty to put up the American flag on a 60-foot pole, and this morning I put it up and went home to bed. When I came back in the evening, the regular cops were sitting around in the office. Say, Bo, what was all that noise around here last night? We've had complaints from people who live across the canyon. I don't know, I said. It sounds pretty quiet right now. And another thing, do you know you can go to jail for raising the American flag upside down? Upside down? I was horrified. Yes, sir, said a fat cop who'd spent 22 years as a guard in Alcatraz. You could go to jail for doing something like that. The others nodded grimly. Many a night, Remy and I were on duty together alone. The barracks cafeteria was our meat. We made sure nobody was watching. Then I squatted down, and Remy put a foot on each shoulder, and up we went. He opened the window, which was never locked because he saw to it in the evenings, scrambled through and came down on the flower table. I was a little more agile and just jumped and scrambled in. "You know what President Truman said," Remy would say, "we must cut down on the cost of living." One night when he was off duty and I was all alone on the base, a strange thing happened. I was taking a walk along the old canyon trail when I heard a noise in the dark. It was a huffing and puffing. I thought it was a rhinoceros. A tall figure appeared in the gloom. It had an enormous head. Suddenly I realized it was Remy with a huge box of groceries on his shoulder. He was moaning and groaning from the weight of it. He'd found the key to the cafeteria somewhere and had got his groceries out the front door. I said, "Remy, what the hell are you doing?" And he said, "Paradise, I have told you several times what President Truman said. We must cut down on the cost of living." And I heard him huff and puff into the darkness. Soon everything began to collapse with Remy and Leanne and me. The September rains came, and with them harangues. Things grew worse. Leanne originally lived in this place first, so she told Remy to pack up and get out. He started packing. I tried to intervene. Remy pushed Leanne. Leanne began screaming, and finally she put on her raincoat and went out in the mud to find a cop. Luckily, he wasn't home. She came back all wet. I hid in my corner with my head between my knees. God, what was I doing 3,000 miles from home? Why had I come here? Where was my slow boat to China? In the morning, Remy and Leanne were asleep as I quietly packed and slipped out the window the same way I'd come in and left Mill City with my canvas bag. In Oakland, I had a beer among the bums of a saloon with a wagon wheel in front of it, and I was on the road again. I walked clear across Oakland to get on the Fresno Road. Two rides took me to Bakersfield, 400 miles south. The second let me off south of Bakersfield. It grew cold. I walked into town to the bus station and sat down on a bench. I had bought my ticket and was waiting for the L.A. bus when all of a sudden I saw the cutest little Mexican girl in slacks. Her breast stuck out straight and true. Her little flanks looked delicious. Her hair was long and lustrous black, and her eyes were great big blue things with timidities inside. A pain stabbed my heart, as it did every time I saw a girl I loved who was going the opposite direction in this too-big world. The announcer called the L.A. bus. I picked up my bag and got on, and who should be sitting there all alone but the Mexican girl? I dropped right opposite, and before I knew what I was doing, I leaned across the aisle to her. She was trying to sleep on the seat and said, "Miss, would you like to use my raincoat for a pillow?" She looked up with a smile and said, "No, thank you very much." I lit a butt. I waited till she looked at me, and I got right up and leaned over her. "May I sit with you, miss?" "If you wish." And this I did. "Where are you going?"
"L.A.
I love the way she said L.A. I love the way everybody says L.A. on the coast. "That's where I'm going, too," I cried. Her story was this. She had a husband and a child. The husband beat her, so she left him back in Sabinal, south of Fresno, and was going to L.A. to live with her sister a while. She had left her little son with her family, who were grape pickers and lived in a shack in the vineyards. I felt like putting my arms around her right away. The bus groaned up Grapevine Pass, and then we were coming down into the great sprawls of light. We began holding hands, and it was mutely and beautifully and purely decided that when I got my hotel room, she would be beside me. I ached all over for her. I leaned my head in her beautiful hair. Her little shoulders drove me mad. I hugged her and hugged her, and she loved it. "I love love," she said, closing her eyes. I promised her beautiful love. We subsided into silence and sweet anticipatory thoughts. It was as simple as that. The first hotel we hit had a room, and before I knew it, I was locking the door behind me, and she was sitting on the bed taking off her shoes. In silence, she took all her clothes off and slipped her tiny body into the sheets. It was brown as grapes. I saw her poor belly where there was a cesarean scar. Her hips were so narrow, she couldn't bear a child without getting gashed open. I made love to her in the sweetness of the weary morning. Then two tired angels of some kind hung up forlornly in an L.A. shelf. We fell asleep till late afternoon. We were very happy in our little hotel room. Not so happy trying to get a buck together. We went to Hollywood to try to work in the drugstore at Sunset and Vine, and we tried to get jobs at the drive-ins. It was no soap anywhere. "Man, I'm going to get my clothes from Sis, and we'll hitchhike to New York," said Terry. That was her name. "Come on, man, let's do it. If you can't boogie, I know I'll show you how." That last part was a song of hers she kept singing. We hurried to her sister's house in the sliverous Mexican shacks somewhere beyond Alameda Avenue. I waited in a dark alley. Dogs ran by. I could hear Terry and her sister arguing in the soft, warm night. Terry came out and led me by the hand to Central Avenue, which is the colored main drag of L.A. We went up dirty tenement stairs and came to the room of Terry's friend Margarina, who owed Terry a skirt and a pair of shoes. Margarina was a lovely mulatto. Her husband was as black as spades and kindly. Terry got her clothes and we said goodbye. We went down to a chicken shack and played records on the jukebox. A couple of Negro characters whispered in my ear about tea, a buck. I said, "Okay, bring it." The connection came in and motioned me to the cellar toilet. "Pick up, man, pick up." "Pick up what?" I said. He was afraid to point at the floor. There lay something that looked like a little brown turd. He was absurdly cautious. "Got to look out for myself. Things ain't cool this past week." I picked up the turd, which was a brown paper cigarette, and went back to Terry, and off we went to the hotel room to get high. Nothing happened. It was Bull Durham tobacco. I wish I was wiser with my money. Terry had a new idea. We would hitchhike to Sabinal, her hometown, and live in her brother's garage. On the road, I made Terry sit down on my bag to make her look like a woman in distress, and right off, a truck stopped, and we ran for it, all glee giggles. The man was a good man. His truck was poor. It roared and crawled on up the valley. We got to Sabinal in the wee hours before dawn. I took Terry to an old hotel, and we slept comfortably. In the bright, sunny morning, Terry got up early and went to find her brother. I slept till noon. Terry came back. Her brother was a wild buck Mexican hot cat with a hunger for booze, a great good kid. His buddy was called Ponzo, a flabby Mexican who spoke English without much accent. She also brought with her her son Johnny, 7 years old, dark-eyed and sweet. Her brother's name was Ricky. He had a .38 Chevy. "What we need is a drink," he yelled, and off we went to a crossroads saloon. Ricky and I and Ponzo and Terry sat drinking and shouting with the music. Little baby Johnny goofed with other children around the jukebox. "Mañana," said Ricky. "Mañana, man, we make it. Have another beer, man. There you go, there you go." We went back to Fresno in the highway lights of night. We were all raving hungry. We had tacos and mashed pinto beans rolled in tortillas. It was delicious. Terry and I looked at each other. "Where are you going to sleep tonight, baby?" "I don't know." We drove back to Sabinal. On the way, we pulled up sharp at a roadhouse on Highway 99. Ricky wanted one last beer. In back of the roadhouse were trailers and tents, and a few rickety motel-style rooms. I inquired about the price, and it was $2. I asked Terry how about it, and she said fine, because we had the kid on our hands now and had to make him comfortable. So Terry and I and Johnny got ready to hit the sack. In the morning, I got up, washed, and took a walk around the place. We were 5 miles out of Sabinal in the cotton fields and grape vineyards. I asked the big fat woman who owned the place if any of the tents were vacant. The cheapest one, $1 a day, was vacant. I fished up $1 and moved into it. There was a bed, a stove, and a cracked mirror hanging from a pole. It was delightful. Nothing was going to happen except starvation for the three of us, so I walked around the countryside asking for cotton picking work. Everybody told me to go to the farm across the highway from the camp. I went, and the farmer was in the kitchen with his women. He came out, listened to my story, and warned me he was only paying $3 per 100 pounds of picked cotton. I pictured myself picking at least 300 pounds a day and took the job. He fished out some long canvas bags from the barn and told me the picking started at dawn. In a larger tent next to ours lived a whole family of oaky cotton pickers. The grandfather sat in a chair all day long. He was too old to work. The son and daughter and their children filed across the highway every day and went to work. At dawn the next day, I went with them. They said the cotton was heavier at dawn because of the dew, and you could make more money than in the afternoon. We bent down and began picking cotton. It was beautiful. Across the fields were the tents, and beyond them the sear brown cotton fields that stretched out of sight to the Arroyo foothills, and then the snow-capped Sierras in the blue morning air. But I knew nothing about picking cotton. I spent too much time disengaging the white ball from its crackly bed. The others did it in one flick. My fingertips began to bleed. I needed gloves or more experience. My back began to ache, but it was beautiful, kneeling and hiding in that earth. Birds sang an accompaniment. I thought I had found my life's work. Johnny and Terry came waving at me across the field in the hot, lull noon and pitched in with me. Be damned if little Johnny wasn't faster than I was. And of course Terry was twice as fast. They worked ahead of me and left me clean piles of cotton to add to my bag. Terry workmanlike piles, Johnny little childly piles. When the sun got red, we trudged back together. At the end of the field, I unloaded my burden on a scale. It weighed 50 pounds, and I got $1.50. Then I borrowed a bicycle from one of the Okie boys and rode down 99 to a Crossroads grocery store, where I bought cans of cooked spaghetti and meatballs, bread, butter, coffee, and cake, and came back with the bag on the handlebars. Terry warmed up the food, and it was one of the greatest meals of my life. I was so hungry and tired. I reclined on the bed and smoked a cigarette. Dogs barked in the cool night. Terry curled up beside me. Johnny sat on my chest. The light of our tent burned on the plain. Cowboy music twanged in the roadhouse and carried across the fields, all sadness. It was all right with me. I kissed my baby, and we put out the lights. Every day I earned approximately $1.50. It was just enough to buy groceries in the evening. The days rolled by. I forgot all about the East and all about Dean and Carlo and the bloody road. Johnny and I played all the time. He liked me to throw him up in the air and down on the bed. Terry sat mending clothes. I was a man of the earth, precisely as I had dreamed I would be back in Patterson. But now it was October and getting much colder in the nights. The Okie family had a wood stove and planned to stay for the winter. We had nothing. Terry and I decided we'd have to leave. Go back to your family, I said. For God's sake, you can't be batting around tents with a baby like Johnny. The poor little tyke is cold. Terry cried because I was criticizing her motherly instincts. I meant no such thing. When Ponzo came over one gray afternoon, we decided to see her family about the situation. We drove to the family shack. It was situated on the old road that ran between the vineyards. It was dark when we got there. They left me a quarter mile away and drove to the door. Light poured out. Terry's brothers were playing their guitars and singing. The old man was drinking wine. I heard shouts and arguments. They called her a whore because she'd left her husband and gone to L.A. and left Johnny with them. The old man was yelling, but the sad, fat, brown mother prevailed, and Terry was allowed to come back home. Terry and Ponzo came back. Terry held me tight and told me not to leave. She said she'd work picking grapes and make enough money for both of us. Meanwhile, I could live in Farmer Heffelfinger's barn down the road from her family. I'd have nothing to do but sit in the grass all day and eat grapes. You like that? Terry led me to Farmer Heffelfinger's barn. We put crates together. She brought blankets from the house, and I was all set. Terry went home for supper and came to the barn at 9 o'clock with delicious tortillas and mashed beans. I lit a wood fire. We made love. Terry got up and cut right back to the shack. Her father was yelling at her. In the morning, Farmer Heffelfinger stuck his head through the horse gate and said, "How you doing, young fella?" "Fine. I hope it's all right, my sleeping here." "Sure thing. You going with that little Mexican floozy? She's a very nice girl. Very pretty, too. I think the bull jumped the fence. She's got blue eyes." We talked about his farm. Terry brought my breakfast. I had my canvas bag all packed and ready to go to New York. I told Terry I was leaving. She'd been thinking about it all night and was resigned to it. She kissed me in the vineyard and walked off down the row. We turned at 12 paces and looked at each other for the last time. I walked down the highway to Sabinal, eating black walnuts from the walnut tree. I suddenly realized it was fall, and I was going back to New York. The ride I proceeded to get was a skinny, haggard man who believed in controlled starvation for the sake of health. When I told him that I was starving to death as we rolled east, he said, "Fine, fine, there's nothing better for you. I myself haven't eaten for 3 days. I'm going to live to be 150 years old. I might have gotten a ride with a fat man who'd say, "Let's stop and have some pork chops and beans." No, I had to get a ride with a maniac who believed in controlled starvation for the sake of health. Still, the maniac drove me home to New York. When I got home, I ate everything in the icebox. My aunt looked at me. "Poor little Salvatore," she said in Italian. "You're thin, you're thin. Where have you been all this time?" The first cold winds rattled the window pane, and I had made it just in time. Dean had come to my house and slept several nights there waiting for me. Then he had left 2 days before I arrived to go to San Francisco. He had his own life there. Camille had just gotten an apartment. At Christmas 1948, my aunt and I went down to visit my brother in Virginia, laden with presents. I had been writing to Dean, and he said he was coming east again, and I told him that he would find me in Testament, Virginia, between Christmas and New Year's. One day, when all our southern relatives were sitting around the parlor, a mud-spattered Hudson drew up in front of the house on the dirt road. I opened the door and suddenly realized it was Dean. In the car, I could see two figures sleeping. I'll be goddamn, Dean, who's in the car? "Hello, hello, man. It's Mary Lou and Ed Dunkel. We've got to have a place to wash up immediately. We're dog-tired." My brother had just bought a new parlor set, and the old one was going to my aunt's house in Patterson. When Dean heard this, he at once offered his services with the Hudson. He and I would carry the furniture to Patterson in two fast trips, taking my aunt back on the second. This was going to save us a lot of money and trouble. It was agreed upon. My sister-in-law made a spread, and the three battered travelers sat down to eat. Mary Lou had not slept since Denver. I thought she looked older and more beautiful now. I learned that Dean had lived happily with Camille in San Francisco ever since that fall of 1947. He became the father of a little girl, Amy Moriarty. Then suddenly he blew his top while walking down the street one day. He saw a Hudson for sale and rushed to the bank for his entire roll. He bought the car on the spot. Ed Dunkel was with him. Now they were broke. Dean calmed Camille's fears and told her he'd be back in a month. "I'm going to New York and bring Sal back." She wasn't too pleased at this prospect. Dean had been working on the railroad. So had big, tall Ed Dunkel. They had both just been laid off because of a reduction of crews. Ed met a girl called Galatia, who was living in San Francisco on her savings. He and Dean decided to bring the girl along to the east and have her foot the bill. Ed cajoled and pleaded. She wouldn't go unless he married her. In a whirlwind few days, Ed married Galatia, and a few days before Christmas, they rolled out of San Francisco at 70 miles per hour. All along the way, Galatia kept complaining that she was tired and wanted to sleep in a motel. If this kept up, they'd spend all her money long before Virginia. By the time they got to Tucson, she was broke. Dean and Ed gave her the slip in a hotel lobby and resumed the voyage alone and without a qualm. Ed Dunkel was a tall, calm, unthinking fellow who was completely ready to do anything Dean asked him. And at this time, Dean was too busy for scruples. He was roaring through Las Cruces, New Mexico, when he suddenly had an explosive yen to see his sweet first wife, Mary Lou, again. She was up in Denver. He swung the car north. He found Mary Lou in a hotel. They had 10 hours of wild lovemaking. Everything was decided again. They were going to stick. Mary Lou was the only girl Dean really loved. She understood Dean. She stroked his hair. She knew he was mad. Dean, Mary Lou, and Ed roared east along Colfax and out to the Kansas Plains. Great snowstorms overtook them. They crossed the Smoky Mountains in midwinter. When they arrived at my brother's door, they had not eaten for 30 hours, except for candy and cheese crackers. We packed my brother's furniture in back of the car and took off at dark, promising to be back in 30 hours. 30 hours for 1,000 miles north and south. But that's the way Dean wanted it. It was a tough trip, and none of us noticed. The heater was not working, and consequently the windshield developed fog and ice. Dean kept reaching out while driving 70 to wipe it with a rag and make a hole to see the road. Off we went, north to Washington, on 301, a straight two-lane highway without much traffic. In New York, I had been romancing a girl called Lucille, a beautiful Italian that I actually wanted to marry. I told Dean, Mary Lou wanted to know all about her. She wanted to meet her. We zoomed through Richmond, Washington, Baltimore, and up to Philadelphia on a winding country road and talked. It was a merry night. When daybreak came, we were rushing through New Jersey with the great cloud of metropolitan New York rising before us in the snowy distance. Dean had a sweater wrapped around his ears to keep warm. We went to my house in Patterson and slept. I was the first to wake up late in the afternoon. A phone call came from me in the drugstore downstairs. It was old Bull Lee, who'd moved to New Orleans. Old Bull Lee, in his high, whining voice, was making a complaint. It seemed a girl called Galatia Dunkel had just arrived at his house looking for a guy called Ed Dunkel. Bull had no idea who these people were. I told Bull to reassure her that Ed was with Dean and me and that most likely we'd be picking her up in New Orleans on the way to the coast. Then the girl herself talked on the phone. How do you get from Tucson to New Orleans? I asked. She said she wired home for money and took a bus. She was determined to catch up with Ed because she loved him. Then we called Carlo at his home in Long Island and told him to come over. Meanwhile, Dean and I got ready for our return trip alone to Virginia to pick up the rest of the furniture and bring my aunt back. Carlo arrived 2 hours later, poetry under his arm, and sat in an easy chair watching us with beady eyes. For the first half hour, he refused to say anything. He refused to commit himself. Dean sat on the floor with a music box and listened with tremendous amazement to the little song it played. A fine romance, he said. Little tinkling, whirling doodle bells. Ah, listen. We'll all bend down together and look into the center of the music box till we learn about the secrets. Tinkly doodle bell. Whee! Carlo watched this madness with slitted eyes. Finally, he slapped his knee and said, What is the meaning of this voyage to New York? What kind of sordid business are you on now? I mean, man, whither goest thou? Whither goest thou, America, in thy shiny car in the night? Whither goest thou, echoed Dean, with his mouth open. We sat and didn't know what to say. There was nothing to talk about. The only thing to do was go. Taking turns at the wheel, Dean and I made Virginia in 10 hours. Now, this is the first time we've been alone and in a position to talk for years, said Dean. And he talked all night. He was out of his mind with real belief. And, of course, now no one can tell us that there is no God. We've passed through all forms. Everything is fine. God exists. We know time. Everything since the Greeks has been predicated wrong. You can't make it with geometry and geometrical systems of thinking. It's all this. He wrapped his finger in his fist. The car hugged the line straight and true. I moaned about life's troubles. Troubles, you see, is the generalization word for what God exists in. The thing is not to get hung up. My head rings, he cried, clasping his head. Since Denver, Sal, I've thought and thought. I used to be in reform school all the time. I was a young punk, asserting myself, stealing cars, a psychological expression of my position. All my jail problems are pretty straight now. As far as I know, I shall never be in jail again. The rest is not my fault. We passed a little kid who was throwing stones at the cars. Think of it, said Dean. One day he'll put a stone through a man's windshield, and the man will crash and die, all on account of that little kid. You see what I mean? God exists without qualms. As we roll along this way, I am positive, beyond doubt, that everything will be taken care of for us, that even you, as you drive, fearful of the wheel, I hated to drive and drove carefully, the thing will go along of itself, and you won't go off the road, and I can sleep. There was nothing clear about the things he said, but somehow what he meant to say was clear. He used the word pure a great deal. I had never dreamed Dean would become a mystic. These were the first days of his mysticism, which would lead to the strange, ragged W.C. Fields saintliness of his later days. Even my aunt listened to him with a curious half ear as we roared back to New York with the furniture in the back. We arrived at the house to find Mary Lou and Ed Dunkel sitting around smoking butts from the ashtrays. They hadn't eaten since Dean and I left. My aunt bought groceries and cooked up a tremendous meal. The New Year's weekend began and lasted 3 days and three nights. Great gangs got into Dean's Hudson and swerved in the snowy New York streets from party to party. I brought Lucille and her sister to the biggest party. When Lucille saw me with Dean and Mary Lou, her face darkened. She sensed the madness they put in me. Then Mary Lou began making love to me. She said Dean was going to return to Camille, and she wanted me to go with her. Come back to San Francisco with us. I'll be a good girl for you. But I knew Dean loved Mary Lou, and I also knew Mary Lou was doing this to make Lucille jealous. Still in all, I licked my lips for this luscious blonde. When Lucille saw Mary Lou pushing me into the corners and giving me the word and forcing kisses on me, she accepted Dean's invitation to go out in the car. But they just talked and drank some of the southern moonshine I'd left in the compartment. Everything was being mixed up and all was falling. I didn't know what was happening to me. And then I suddenly realized that it was only the tea that we were smoking. Dean had bought some in New York. It made me think that everything was about to arrive, the moment when you know all and everything is decided forever. What I wanted was to take one more magnificent trip to the West Coast and get back in time for the spring semester in school. I went along for the ride and to see what Dean was going to do. Also, I wanted to have an affair with Mary Lou. What was on Mary Lou's mind, I don't know. Ed Dunkel, as ever, just followed. We got ready to cross the groaning continent again. I drew my GI check and gave Dean $18 to mail to his wife. She was waiting for him to come home, and she was broke. There were long days spent in Carlo's apartment before we left. He went around in his bathrobe and made semi-ironical speeches. Dean, why did you leave Camille and pick up Mary Lou? No answer. Giggles. Mary Lou, why are you traveling around the country like this? Same answer. Ed Dunkel, why did you abandon your new wife in Tucson, and what are you doing here sitting on your big fat arse? Where is your home? What's your job? Ed Dunkel bowed his head in genuine befuddlement. Sal, how comes it you've fallen on such sloppy days, and what have you done with Lucille? He adjusted his bathrobe and sat facing us all. The days of wrath are yet to come. The balloon won't sustain you much longer. And not only that, but it's an abstract balloon. Carlo wasn't sleeping anymore these days. Ech, he screamed. He was going out of his mind from the confusion of jam on the floor, pants, dresses thrown around, cigarette butts, dirty dishes, open books. It was time to go. We were all delighted. We all realized we were leaving confusion and nonsense behind and performing our one and noble function of the time. Move. And we moved. We flashed past the mysterious white signs in the night somewhere in New Jersey that say south with an arrow and west with an arrow and took the south one. New Orleans. It burned in our brains. From the dirty snows of frosty fag town New York, as Dean called it, all the way to the greeneries and river smells of old New Orleans at the washed out bottom of America, then west. Dean suddenly became tender. Now, damn it, look here, all of you. We must admit that everything is fine and there's no need in the world to worry. And in fact, we should realize what it would mean to us to understand that we're not really worried about anything. Am I right? We all agreed. Here we go. We're all together. What did we do in New York? Let's forgive. The white line in the middle of the highway unrolled and hugged our left front tire as if glued to our groove. We arrived in Washington at dawn. Dean went to sleep in the back seat and Dunkel drove. We gave him instructions to take it easy. No sooner were we snoring than he gunned the car up to 80, and not only that, but he made a triple pass at a spot where a cop was arguing with a motorist. Naturally, the cop took after us with his siren whining. We were stopped. They fined us $25, and we told them we only had 40 to go all the way to the coast. They said that made no difference to them. Now we had $15. I drove through South Carolina and beyond Macon, Georgia, as Dean, Mary Lou, and Ed slept. All alone in the night, I had my own thoughts and held the car to the white line in the holy road. I got dog-tired beyond Macon and woke up Dean. We got out of the car for air, and suddenly both of us were stoned with joy to realize that in the darkness all around us was fragrant green grass and the smell of fresh manure and warm waters. We're in the South. We've left the winter. 10 miles down the road, Dean drove into a filling station with the motor off, noticed that the attendant was fast asleep at the desk, jumped out, quietly filled the tank, saw to it that the bell didn't ring, and rolled off like an Arab